to this moment. But we'll try to steer the deliberations in such a way that we still fall within the normal budgeted time for these public hearings. What I have to do is just to make sure that I control the presenters. Fortunately, I know them very well by now. And honorable members, you'll help me in that regard. We have they've attended in large numbers more than the public that is supposed to present to us. That says to me the interest from their side to make sure that this bill and this amendment are processed is quite high. Let me take this opportunity to welcome all of you. Our first presenters is going to be PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC. You hear? Okay. The second presentation will take it after your presentation, and the deliberations will be done simultaneously. Thank you very much. You'll introduce yourself. I don't want to take the risk of mutilating your names and surnames, as my surname is always mutilated most of the time. Some say Mafumadi and all that. Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Osman Mwaloji. I am an associate professor at the University of the Western Cape, and I'm also a partner at PwC. I don't mind if you mutilate my surname. I'm okay with that. The majority of today's discussion is going to be led by my colleague, Kyle Mandy, sitting next to me, who's also the head of PwC's tax technical unit. Over to you, Kyle.
Thank you, Osman. Good. Just to set out the agenda that we're going to cover today, these are just some of the major issues that that we've highlighted in our written submissions to the committee, but we're going to concentrate on these few items that we would like to emphasize as well. So without further ado, I'll just move on to the first item, which is a question around the balance of the tax administration bill itself. What we have seen in this bill is a significant increase in both the powers that are granted to SARS for purposes of administering tax acts, as well as the obligations placed on taxpayers. We've listed out a number of these additional powers and obligations that have been imposed by the tax administration bill. I don't want to go through all of them, but these are just some of them, and I'll highlight a few. SARS has additional powers of inspection, additional powers to interview taxpayers, powers to search without warrants, rights to demand security for payment of taxes, powers to accelerate tax payments, powers to seize and preserve assets, powers to hold third parties liable for tax debts, the power to hold back refunds subject to audit, significantly increased penalties, and enhanced criminal offences. As I said, those are just some of the additional powers that have been granted to SARS under this bill. Okay. By the same token, there are just a few additional rights that have been granted to taxpayers. Some of these we'll talk about a little bit more, but for example, we're talking about the introduction of the tax ombud, and we'll come back to that in a moment in terms of our further submissions and slides at a later stage. Rights for taxpayers to be kept informed of audit progress, and even there we have some concerns about the limitations placed on those rights afforded to taxpayers, or for more pertinently, for the ability of SARS to override those rights in certain circumstances. the reduction in the prescription for tax debts from 30 years to 15 years, well, that's a very minor concession on the part of SARS. I mean, if you haven't managed to collect your tax debts within 15 years, what are the chances you're going to collect them within 30 years anyway? And the permanent voluntary disclosure program, which we welcome. The bottom line of this is that the bill as it stands, contrary to what SARS has presented to you, is far from balanced. Balance does not amount to having in place checks and balances in the form of approvals by senior SARS officials in order to invoke certain of the powers of SARS. That is not balance. Balance comes when additional powers and obligations granted to SARS and imposed on taxpayers respectively are balanced with additional taxpayer rights. And this bill is sorely lacking in that respect. We're concerned that there is potential for abuse of certain, if not most, of these additional powers that have been granted to SARS against compliant taxpayers. And I'll use a practical example just to illustrate that. SARS has the right to audit taxpayers, and we have no issue with that. The problem comes in is that, well, if they are then also obliged, as I mentioned earlier, to keep taxpayers informed of audit progress, but they're granted the right to override that requirement in certain circumstances. And those circumstances include where, in SARS's opinion, the outcome of the audit would be prejudiced should they actually continue that. And the example that they use in their memorandum of objects is where assessments are about to prescribe. So we end up with a situation where SARS now ignores that right to taxpayers and issues assessments without getting representations from taxpayers before raising those assessments on the grounds that the assessment's about to prescribe, notwithstanding that they have between 3 and 5 years in which to raise assessments. Then what SARS often do in certain circumstances is make the date for payment of that assessment. Let's say the assessment is raised on the 30th of July, or sorry, the 30th of March, and they make the payment due date for payment of that assessment the 31st of March. They then immediately appoint the taxpayer's bankers as an agent under the old legislation, or send them a notice requiring them to make payment of the taxpayer's debts under the proposed legislation, and effectively collect payment immediately. Okay. What I've illustrated to you here is not a theoretical example. This actually happens in real life, and we encounter it on a regular basis, and it's becoming more and more commonplace, particularly around the end of the government financial year when SARS is under pressure to collect revenues. Okay. We see this happening on a regular basis. Osman, I can hand over to you.
Thanks, Kyle. If I can just continue that, and before I do, I mean, I think for those of you who know me will know that I have this tendency to repeat what other people have said and also to repeat myself, so please bear with me. Just continuing along the vein of what Kyle has started about the balance that we're talking about, I do want to clarify the point here. If we come from the standpoint that the majority of SARS officials are reasonable people and the majority of taxpayers are compliant, I think no one has a problem that, you know, you can come up with whatever percentage, maybe 60, 70, 80, 90% of taxpayers are compliant and keep their affairs in order. I think what we're dealing with here are the fringes. Now, so, and this is our complaint, that SARS has looked at only one extreme, and that is the extreme where you have a reasonable SARS auditor, but you have a downright abusive taxpayer. I don't think anyone should be in denial about that scenario, and SARS do need the power, and we support that, to deal with those scenarios. At the other end of the spectrum is the scenario that is not dealt with. And that is where, and I don't think, I want to ask us to not be in denial about this, where you have a reasonable taxpayer, but you have a SARS official who has the ability to abuse those powers, to operate like they are a law unto themselves, because we are looking at legislation here that will effectively open the door for that kind of thing. So, everything that we're about to say is what we're saying is the additional powers that are given to SARS for those extreme cases, they are required. But don't forget to protect ordinary citizens. We've got some examples on the slide. I'm not going to go through all of them. The first two, I'm not going to talk about at all, because Kyle will talk about them in a little bit more detail after the slide. And I want to use some examples. The first one is just about what is considered to be generally accepted practice, SARS practice. And our point here is SARS puts out a lot of communications, a lot of publications, and these are expressions of this is how we see things, this is how we apply the law, this is our interpretation. Included in this are things like guides. So our request here is that if you put out in the public domain a statement of your interpretation, taxpayers should be allowed to rely on that. If they follow a particular, I mean, we have mammoth guides like on STC and CGT. If you see something in there and you fill in your taxes according to the SARS guide, SARS shouldn't be allowed to come back 2 years later and say, well, you followed that, but we've changed our mind. So if you do things in accordance with what SARS's position is at the time, SARS shouldn't be allowed to challenge that. And so our request here is the meaning of official publications should be broadened. The next question I want to deal with is the issue of search and seizure. Now, constitutionally in this country, the search and seizure of private premises is considered to be a right of South African citizens that is not easily infringed. The Constitutional Court of this country has made it point of clarifying that one of the safeguards for when that right can be infringed, one of the safeguards is when there's a warrant. Now, what we have in this bill is the ability for SARS officials to search and seize without a warrant. And going further, just talking about the constitutionality of that, what the Constitutional Court has also held is that, okay, if you do have the scenario in extreme certain circumstances, then we need to be very clear. I mean, first of all, you've allowed search and seizure and you said the warrant is the safeguard. And now when you remove that, we're entering very dangerous territory here. And I want to make the point that insofar as holding potential SARS officials into account, third-party review in the area of search and seizure without a warrant, there's zero in the bill, nothing. Nothing at all. And again, I'm not saying SARS shouldn't be allowed to have the power to search and seize without a warrant, because, again, those extreme abuses, sometimes it's warranted. But, I mean, let's just make sure that we don't open the door for abuses of power. Carl's already mentioned this point, so I'll deal with it relatively quickly. And this is the issue of the conclusion of an investigation and an audit, or an audit. SARS does have, imposes upon themselves, and this is in terms of, in keeping with FAJA anyway, the requirement to report to you as a taxpayer saying, this, we've done the investigation, this is what we find, and this is what we're about to do. We're about to charge you extra tax of higher, whatever the amount is, and give you the opportunity to explain yourself, to make representations. What this bill does is to say, well, in some cases, we don't think that's necessary. We all think that, okay, if we're going to run out of time, we're just going to go ahead and assess you and demand the tax anyway, without giving you the opportunity to explain yourself. So a concern there as well. This is an interesting one. The due date, once an assessment is issued, the expectation should be that if the assessment is issued today, then you'll have a reasonable time to pay it. What we have in practice in real life today is that you have, normally our expectation is 30 days, 40 days, 20 days, or I don't know, 14 days. We have assessments already being issued, making the due date today before you even receive it. So the assessment is issued today. You'll probably expect to receive it later today if you're on e-filing or tomorrow, but the due date is today. And we've even had examples where the due date was before the assessment was issued. So again, our request is that it's only fair to have some kind of lead time. Collection of taxes from third parties. That was about due dates for the payment of assessments. When a taxpayer is assessed, how long are they given to actually pay the assessment? It can't be the same day that the assessment is issued, and it needs to be some kind of reasonable time. And I must admit, in the majority of cases, it is reasonable. You have 30 days or 40 days or something like that. But my question again is, what is there to prevent SARS from issuing an assessment with a due date like in the past, for example? Because remember, interest starts running from the due date, and we have had real live examples where this has happened already. Then, the ability to collect your taxes from third parties. This is where SARS has the authority to go to your bank, your personal bank, and empty out your bank account and say to your banker, give us all the money because that client of yours owes us tax, or to go to your employer and tell your employer, don't pay over the end of the month salary to the employee, pay it to us because tax is owed. Now again, the point for this, and again, this is a power that SARS does need, because again, people sometimes just simply don't pay their taxes. But in discussions, the impression that we've been given is that the purpose or the intention was that this power is supposed to be used subject to two considerations or two restrictions. Number one, as a last resort, when you've exhausted all, you know, you've sent demands and you've told the taxpayer that you owe, and you know we're going to take more extreme measures. That's point number one, as a last resort. And point number two, with due consideration for other hardships that might be caused. Because imagine a business. It's the day before you have to pay all your employees. You've got 1,000 employees and you have to pay all your employees tomorrow, and today SARS just instructs your bank to empty out your bank account. So those two considerations should be there, written in the legislation, and again, we have real live examples where this is already happening, where number one, the approach to third parties happens not as a last resort, as a first resort. And without due consideration for other cash flow requirements. Maybe we'll get the questions and the questions and answers, but there's some real live examples that we can take, and I won't deal with them in the interest of time. That was the last thing that I wanted to say on the slide. There's some others as well, but we'll come to that in a little bit more detail. Back over to you, Kyle.
Thank you, Osman. I think to sum up in that respect, I mean, what SARS have indicated to you is that this bill differentiates between compliant taxpayers and non-compliant taxpayers. The bottom line, though, is it does not. In theory, yes, we're SARS to apply it in that way, it would, but from a legislative perspective, it does not differentiate between compliant and non-compliant taxpayers whatsoever. Okay, moving on to our next topic is in relation to the tax on BUD. In general, we welcome this proposal. It's something that's been a long time coming and we support it wholly. However, we do have some concerns. The first concern is around the independence of the tax on BUD. The proposal is that the tax on BUD will be funded by SARS, and the employees of the tax on BUD will be SARS employees seconded to the tax on BUD. Now, we're accountants, and when we talk about independence from an accounting perspective, we talk about being factually independent and being seen to be independent. Okay. Well, the bottom line is even if the tax on BUD is factually independent, he certainly will not be seen to be independent by taxpayers by virtue of those two factors, being funded by SARS and being staffed by SARS employees on secondment. The other concern that we have is around the limited powers that have been granted or proposed to be granted to the tax on BUD. Those powers are limited to review and mediation of administrative matters. We have no concerns around the limitation to administrative matters. We think that fits into the international precedent and precisely fits into the scope of this bill itself. However, the Ombud has no powers to compel SARS to do anything, and that is a concern to us. The further point is that, well, in effect, because the Ombud has no power to compel SARS to do anything, in effect, this is nothing more than a legislated form of the existing service monitoring office, and in fact creates an additional layer that taxpayers need to go through before they can have access to justice in relation to administrative matters. So what we are suggesting here is twofold. First of all, insofar as independence is concerned, while the Ombuds office should be financed directly from Treasury itself and should have its own employees rather than those employees being SARS employees, ultimately reporting to SARS. More importantly, though, from our perspective, is that the Ombud should be granted the power to compel SARS to act to stop acting or refrain from acting in relation to administrative matters. There is international precedent for this, and that international precedent lies in the United States Taxpayer Advocate Office, which has the power to issue what are termed taxpayer-assisted orders on the IRS, and that is precisely what it implies. It is an order on the IRS which tells them to either act, stop acting, or refrain from acting in relation to administrative matters, and we would suggest that a similar power should be granted to the Ombud in South Africa. The next topic that we'd like to raise submissions on is in relation to legal professional privilege. Now, in essence, just to bring everyone up to speed in terms of legal professional privilege is a common law right that has been around for over 300 years. In essence, what it is, it says that communications between lawyers and their clients will be treated as confidential, and no third party will have access to those communications. It applies for communications that are for the purposes of both litigation and legal advice. However, there is concern that legal privilege is arguably only applicable to communications between lawyers and their clients, and not between other persons providing legal advice and their clients. The rationale for the common law legal privilege has been laid down through a long line of case law, but essentially it boils down to it being a fundamental human right. The reason being that legal matters are complex. Okay. Now, not all people are schooled in law. It is designed to promote the open communication between legal advisors and their clients, such that full facts are provided by clients to their legal advisors, such that appropriate legal advice can be given to those clients. It protects the confidentiality of those communications, as I stated earlier. And ultimately, it has been held to be in the public interest to encourage full disclosure between the client and its legal advisor, and that public interest outweighs the competing public interests that the state, for example, or any other persons, parties to litigation may have to full information. Ultimately, what legal professional privilege does is enhance compliance. It reduces the loads on the courts by ensuring that appropriate advice is granted by legal advisors to their clients. And as I say, it increases compliance. Not all communications between clients and their legal advisors are privileged. And again, there's a long line of case law which sets out what communications would be regarded as privileged. But just in summary, the requirements for any communications to be privileged would be that the legal advisor is acting in his professional capacity, the purpose of the communications is obtaining legal advice or for litigation purposes, the communications are made in confidence between those two persons, and the communications are not for purposes of committing a crime. So in other words, any advice that is provided by a lawyer to a client to aid or abet that client in committing a crime will not qualify for legal privilege. As I mentioned earlier, there is now significant uncertainty in terms of whether or not legal privilege would apply to tax advice that is provided by suitably qualified persons who do not happen to be lawyers. And in lawyers, we're talking about admitted attorneys or advocates in the South African context. This precise point is currently the subject of a dispute in the United Kingdom and is shortly to be heard before the Supreme Court in that country. So the uncertainty remains. Essentially, what we are suggesting is that a statutory legal privilege should be extended to non-lawyers for tax advice purposes. The rationale for that is precisely the same as the rationale for the common law legal privilege, which I went through a couple of slides previously. The bottom line is that tax is law. It's a specialist area of law and one of the most complex areas of law. The fact of the matter is that most tax advice, certainly in South Africa and in most jurisdictions around the world, is actually not provided by lawyers. It's provided by accountants and other suitably qualified individuals. As I mentioned, the common law principle of legal professional privilege has been around for in excess of 300 years, having originated in the UK. The bottom line, though, is that the common law has not kept pace with the realities of the modern world. Coming back to this point, that most tax advice is provided by accountants rather than lawyers. Okay. That it might have been the case that 200 years ago, or even 100 years ago, most tax advice would have been provided by lawyers, but that is not the case as we stand today. As I mentioned earlier, tax advisors fulfill a vital role in the economy, insofar as tax is concerned, and importantly, in terms of ensuring taxpayer compliance. Were it not for tax advisors, there would be a lot more non-compliance on the part of taxpayers. Yes, there are tax advisors who abuse the system, but they are in the minority. For the most part, tax advisors provide more in terms of ensuring compliance than they do in terms of ensuring non-compliance. In fact, most legitimate tax advisors would not even advise a client who is not prepared to be compliant. The effect of all of this is that there is potentially an uneven playing field in the tax advisory environment, where on the one hand, lawyers are claiming, and rightfully so, that they have privilege in terms of their communications with their clients, and on the other hand, accountants do not. This has resulted in an unjustified competitive advantage for lawyers versus non-lawyers. And the lawyers are quick to market using that very point itself. And I say the competitive advantage enjoyed by lawyers is unjustified. Lawyers, for the most part, are no more qualified to advise on the tax law than suitably qualified accountants are. In fact, it makes no sense that a lawyer with no tax knowledge whatsoever could communicate with taxpayer clients and that those communications would be privileged, whereas accountants with significant tax experience and knowledge, their communications with their clients would not qualify for legal privilege. Another factor coming into this is that we have seen in recent times a significant increase in what we term mixed practices. And when we talk about mixed practice, we're talking about practices that have both employees that are lawyers and accountants. We see it in the accounting firms, where we as a firm employ both accountants and lawyers in our tax practice, and in the law firms themselves, where probably half of the tax specialists in law firms are actually not lawyers, they're actually accountants. So on that basis, it makes no sense why there should be this differentiation, certainly in terms of, from a tax law perspective, why lawyers should enjoy privilege but accountants should not. SARS will tell you that that as many arguments as there are for privilege being extended to accountants, there are also reasons why and arguments against extending privilege to tax advisors. As I mentioned earlier, there is a competing public interest in that, while SARS should have the fullest possible access to information on taxpayers' affairs. That has been, as I said, addressed by the courts previously, and the very reason why privileges exist is because they've said that the public interest of ensuring full and complete communication between the legal advisors and their clients overrides the competing public interest of ensuring the fullest possible access to information on the part of third parties. So I will also tell you that lawyers have a duty to the court that overrides their duty to clients. That is correct. We cannot argue against that. They'll also tell you that lawyers are regulated and subject to disciplinary processes where accountants are not. Well, that is correct to some extent, but also not fully correct in itself. There are certain professions of accountants who are subject to disciplinary processes within their own professions, albeit that they are not regulated by law. They may also tell you that extending legal privilege to accountants will open the doors for potential abuse of that privilege by advisors impeding and frustrating access to information. Well, the bottom line is that potential for abuse exists already because of the privilege that exists for lawyers. The bottom line is that from our perspective, the arguments for legal privilege being extended to accountants outweighs the arguments against it being so extended. These concerns can also be addressed. There are significant legal precedents for the extension of the legal privilege to accountants in other jurisdictions. And, for example, New Zealand, who do not regulate their tax advisors, they have extended legal privilege to tax advisors who are subject to certain disciplinary processes. For example, accountants who are members of professional bodies. Just in terms of some of the existing legal precedents that are in place, I do not propose to go through these in any detail, but they do exist. The United States has extended legal privilege to non-lawyers. The UK has a limited statutory privilege for accountants. Australia has an accountant's concession and are currently looking at putting in place a legislative framework to extend legal privilege to accountants. As I mentioned earlier, New Zealand have a statutory privilege for accountants. Germany also have a limited statutory privilege. What we are proposing is that, as one of the mechanisms to introduce balance into this bill, that a limited statutory privilege be introduced into the tax administration bill using the New Zealand model as a basis. Okay. We'll not go into the detail of what that entails, but SARS is certainly aware of that practice, and that is the model that we would suggest. If I can pass on to Osmond to continue for the next bit.
You don't have time to continue. You have exceeded your time by 10 minutes, but I'll allow you try to be as quickly as possible, Prof.
Thank you, Chair.
I'll make my job easy, please.
I'll do my best. I'll try and speak really quickly. Okay, the last issue, that's kind of like three separate sub-issues, but they all relate to the ability of SARS to remit penalties. So, and I'll deal with them all of them very quickly. First of all, it's compulsory in terms of the proposals that certain penalties will be levied against taxpayers in certain circumstances, and we don't have a problem with the compulsory nature of them. And I've listed some of the amounts over there that those penalties can run into. Those are all maximum amounts, so I mean those are not fixed penalties. The first two there, they ramp up month by month depending on your non-compliance. So those are just the maximum numbers. Our issue is around this. When can SARS say, okay, in your case, maybe we can waive some of the penalties? At the moment, there are only two cases when the full amount of the penalties can be remitted. Like if you paid late because you died, or because there was some kind of natural disaster, and I don't understand ESCOM blackouts to be a natural disaster, but those kind of things, and under the VDP. Our issue is there are other circumstances when the penalty, when there's a reasonable case for why the penalty should be waived, and that this is not provided for. The only other possibility when there could be partial remission is in the case where the remission of the penalty is limited to a fixed amount, like 2,000 Rand. Now, my point here is that if we look at some of the examples of when they could remit this penalty, like maybe it's your first offence, or maybe there's some reasonable argument that you had, and you thought you were right, but you weren't being facetious or being abusive, you thought you were right, and it's reasonable. And that's fine, and I think that concept is important, but what this provision says is, in that case, if this is your first offence, or if you were actually being entirely reasonable, the maximum amount of penalty that we can give back to you is 2,000 Rand, in some cases. In the case of reportable arrangements, because of time, I'm not going to go into the detail here. My point here is, and maybe some of the members here will remember the whole thing we had about Section 45 early on. Is Section 45 a reportable arrangement? It's just an example I want to put out there. And the fact of the matter is, both within SARS, we've got different opinions, and within the tax practitioner fraternity, is it reportable or not? We have real solid opinions going both ways. What we're saying is, in this kind of case, the taxpayer can take a reasonable position, and if they turn out to be wrong, purely because they were being reasonable, there should be the ability to waive the penalties. I think that example, I'm actually going to stop with that, because there's that concept of the ability to waive penalties when there has been a reasonable argument by the SARS is the thing I think that probably cuts across most of the stuff. I'll just hand over to Kyle. I'll go right to the last slide. If there was anything you wanted to add on that, Kyle.
Yep. I'll deal with this very quickly, Chair. In terms of understatement penalties, the way the legislation is currently drafted is that where there's an understatement of a tax liability on the part of a taxpayer, the minimum penalty that will be imposed in that situation is 25% of the difference between the tax that should have been paid and the tax that was paid. That is even in a situation where the taxpayer has adopted a reasonable position in relation to their tax affairs. If that so happens to be a repeat case, which is where a penalty has been imposed within the last 5 years, the minimum amount we're talking about is 50%. And what we're saying in this respect is that taxpayers should be free to adopt reasonable tax positions without fear of these understatement penalties being imposed, which is not the case currently. And we've got 100 years worth of tax precedent, tax case law, which shows that there is significant room for interpretation in relation to tax affairs. And the bottom line is that we're saying is taxpayers should not be penalised for adopting reasonable positions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I think those slides that you do not have time to go through, as we interact with your presentations later on, will be able, in your responses, you may be able to cover some of those issues. So it's not all in vain, your preparations for these public hearings. We will then...
Thank you.
We are going to take the next... you want to set up? The next presentation will be from SAIT, South African Institute of Tax Practitioners. Is that Lou? I How do you pronounce your name?
Stian.
Oh, yeah. Stian.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
We have Mr. Thomas Tomasek from National Treasury here. He's listening very attentively to all of you. Just a reminder. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chi. Apologies for wearing a hat, for showing disrespect. I've been in an accident in January, so I'm bald on top, and I don't want to show you that baldness with my long hair on the side. So please excuse me for wearing the hat. Thank you very much again. The main issues to consider...
So this accident has been with you for quite some time.
Very, quite some time.
For the past 2 years, you've been wearing this hat.
No.
Okay.
Only since January.
All right.
My colleagues previously has gone into quite detail in terms of the issues being discussed, and being a researcher on the issue of tax administration, I'm the managing author of the textbook for practitioners called Silk on Tax Administration. I've been listening with interest to my colleagues, and I've done an extensive international study in terms of tax administration, even prior to the release of the tax administration bill by SARS. And we can find a number of reasons and a number of international precedent examples for why we should or should not introduce certain sections into our legislation. And without criticizing other copies of international precedent that has been followed, for example, in education, it is important that you, as the committee, need to take a step back. And I would like to start off with that, because I think we jump into detail and we try to determine whether something is right or whether we can find something in the international arena that can support whatever is introduced or actually a reason why not to introduce it. So we, on the one hand, practitioners and professional bodies, we may recommend things that and use, for example, the US example for introducing a tax ombud or at least the model, and SARS would, when they brief you, or National Treasury, would have a different view. As committee, I think it's important that you take a step back, if I may be so bold as to advise, because being listening and taking that step back myself, I actually realized that issues that I've been criticizing in the past, I'm actually in support now for that's been on the table. For example, certain seizures without a warrant, that may be very bold. So apologies to France and to Katinka for criticizing that in the past. Reason being, I think as a country and as parliamentarians, we need to determine what are we trying to achieve with this bill. And rather than getting into the detail and criticizing the detail and finding the national precedent why we should copy something, for example, the US model for a tax ombud or adjudicator, and we on the other side saying the US model is better, determine what are we trying to instill in the public's mind. Are we trying to increase the tax morale of taxpayers and therefore getting more taxpayers into the tax net, them acting a little bit more honest in the tax affairs, declaring all the income, not making mistakes on the tax returns, and it's a perception. And I think that is the foundation that we need to depart from before we jump into the details of the tax administration bill, and any legislation for that matter, because taxation is complex, as my colleagues pointed out. So I just wanted to lay the foundation in terms of the argument that we should take. So, first of all, we would like to commend the drafters of the bill. It's indicated as the first step into simplifying and consolidating the tax legislation. It is very archaic written. It has been added on over a number of years. So this is an excellent step in the right direction. Again, to create simplicity and to increase the morale of taxpayers, because ultimately we would like to collect and increase revenue collection, because as a government you've got a social responsibility and the responsibility to uplift the country, grow the economy and create jobs and to collect and to deliver to services those who need it most. So that's why it's important. When you still take a step back in terms of evaluating this legislation, to ensure that we find an appropriate balance between the rights of taxpayers, honest taxpayers, not only taxpayers, but honest taxpayers, and the rights of SARS, and I put in brackets the country, because SARS is the collector of revenue, that is the money that we spend into providing the social infrastructure and upliftment of the country. Then I'm going to also quickly would just like to refer to the legal professional privilege. Kyle indicated from Pricewaterhouse that there is international debate. There is currently before the Supreme Court of Appeal in the US and the UK the question of whether legal professional privilege should be extended to tax advisors. Again, we can find a number of reasons internationally why international or that legal professional privilege should be supported, but we can also find a number of other countries. So obviously, you've got two sides that you as a committee need to listen to. You've got us on the one hand as practitioners and as the professional bodies, but you also have SARS and National Treasury indicating their reasons why not to extend legal professional privilege. Is that really our debate, or do we rather want to see what we're trying to achieve with if we extend legal professional privilege? I think that should be the question, not whether we can find the national president. I mean, if I can just be so bold as to mention, for example, in the education system, we've adopted Australian outcomes in our education system in Africa. It's been widely criticized. Back then, it was motivated that it's excellent international best practice. Now, in hindsight, we as a country adopted it. And was it so successful? That's questionable. I'm not an expert, education expert, but there has been criticism. So it's important that we remember that just following the national precedent and using it as a basis, whether you use our basis as practitioners or you use SARS's argument for not extending legal professional privilege to tax advisors. Who is right, who is wrong? I think ultimately we need to determine again what we're trying to achieve and then decide whether we will extend legal professional privilege to accountants, or I don't like the word accountant because an accountant is trained as an accountant, not as a law person. Now, our professional body accepts members from both the legal fraternity as well as accountants. We'd rather wish to refer to the word tax practitioners because therefore they have undergone a study and a practice into the workings of taxation law, and hence I support Carl's argument that it may be unfair and discriminating against tax practitioners practicing law not to extend legal professional privilege. But again, that is my argument. We need to take a step back and conceptualize what they're trying to achieve. So I'm concerned if we just refer to legal international best practice. We need to view something holistically. We are a unique country. There are differences in the constitutional and the Bill of Rights of various countries. So just by handpicking or picking a certain section from another country, I don't think we have done an in-depth study into the foundation and the history of that country's legal system, and therefore just adopting that as an example and as an argument to support something or not to support something, I'm just careful of that. And I think over the last 18 years we have seen that we have burnt our fingers in South Africa by just adopting international best practice on face value. Getting to the third point, my third concern is the tax ombud. And I think that is ultimately the answer to the whole debate, whether we certain seize without a warrant, whether we compensate taxpayers for wasted costs, etc. So the detail of the tax administration bill, now that I've taken a step back myself, is not as important as the breaks. I believe that we should have proper breaks in this bill, and I believe that the tax ombud and the proper constitution of the tax ombud is the answer. For example, if there's a tax ombud, let's just use the example of the search and seizure without a warrant. If a source of it should be there, again, what is the idea behind the tax admin bill, and what is the purpose of SARS is to collect the most revenue that is due to the fisc. Do you agree? But, and you have to give them the powers to collect it. Yes, there's a minority tax advisors and taxpayers who are not acting ethically and honest. That's why we have to extend SARS's powers. So Carl pointed out to you the additional powers being given to SARS. Initially, I just looked at those powers and criticized it one by one. But we have to, you can't discriminate against the honest taxpayers and therefore let the unscrupulous taxpayers get away and not giving SARS the means and the mechanisms to collect and to run after those guys. So there have to be the break, because the break is the tax ombud. If you properly constitute a tax ombud, then the SARS official will then know that if I use this power, for example, if a policeman runs after a robber and he shoots him, he needs to know that there are certain recourse against his action. So he must clearly think about before he act. So the tax ombud can fulfill that easy mechanism whereby SARS will be kept accountable to the taxpayers, but also in turn that will increase the tax morale, the morale of the taxpayers, because they know that there's an easy route, inexpensive, without the courts, that they can refer to and that SARS is accountable to. My time is running out. So I think it's important that we just ensure that the tax ombud obtain the powers to achieve the goal that we try to achieve with the tax administration bill. The additional powers should be granted to run after those, but SARS should be kept accountable, and the tax ombud, preferably whether the salaries are paid by SARS, whether it comes from National Treasury, whether it comes from the legal fraternity, I think ultimately that tax ombud should also report to you as the committee. That will address the issue of perceived independence, whether the tax ombud is independent or not. Now, again, going back to the public's, in the public's mind, the taxpayer, independence or they may perceive the tax ombud not to be independent. Whether it's really independent in the mind of the tax ombud itself, or whether it's not, it's the perception of the public. And we need to address it. So we recommend that the tax ombud report and be accountable to the committee. And that point number four I've addressed already. Honourable Chairman already pointed out that my time is running out. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stian Tlu. Honorable members, we have an opportunity to interact with the two submissions before we take or we break for tea. The presentations speak to each other and one another. Of course, it is quite interesting as honorable members to hear that there are also divergent views from the same public presenters or representatives on this particular matter.
but it helps us to actually have a broader understanding of the issues within the legislation, as honourable members. Honourable members, comments and questions for clarity? Honourable Gwaron Wolf, you'll be followed by Honourable Madlamini and Honourable Dr. George and Honourable Swart. Marae, don't take offence, sorry. Honourable Marae. Marae and Swart are too far apart, eh? Good. Okay. Honourable Van Rooyen will follow. I will pass that information to Honourable Swart, that there's a distinction between Marae and Swart even in terms of colour. Thank you.
Thank you.
In that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just would like to have Pricewaterhouse comment on the proposal of talking about tax practitioners, you know, in terms of the legal privilege argument. And then secondly, are you in a hurry to get this legislation? I know SARS, but you as a profession, are you in a hurry? Do you think it's fair that we do it this year? Or do you think we need more time to do a proper job?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the two presenters. My one is just the clarity to PwC. I know that you have both raised the tax ombud issue, but I'm focusing my clarity to the PwC directly. You are indicating that a tax ombud should be an independent body. And having said that, then you find it having a problem if it is going to be located where the SARS is proposing to be located, and also to the secondment of the personnel. That is your problem. Now, I did get some alternative or some solution regarding to that, but I did not get it from the PwC. Where would you like to see the tax ombud? Because both presentation, they don't say the tax ombud needs not to be there, but seemingly the location of the tax ombud is a problem. And also you're talking about the powers, which in particular, these powers that you're talking about, which are they? And the last one, the clarity on the consultation process, which we are having a serious problem. We've got about 15 points there, which says that SARS has been given so much of the powers. And now my question there is, have you gone through what the SARS has proposed as a consultation process in the same bill? The last one, Chair, the collection powers and an extension to the PwC. What are you proposing? What are you proposing so that as the committee we are able to try and work around and analyze whatever information that we have got from the other groups and from SARS and Treasury and be able to say this is the right way that is supposed to be done. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for your presentations. To PwC, on the issue of search and seizure without a warrant, are you saying that you accept the need for search and seizure without a warrant, but that there needs to be some kind of control mechanism, or do you not support it? Then on the independence of the ombud, SARS argues that seconded staff will better understand how SARS operates, and therefore they'd be able to function more effectively in the ombud's office. I would like to know your comment on that. And then why would you need privilege between a tax advisor and a client? Doesn't this suggest that there's something to hide? And then an Institute of Tax Practitioners, on the tax ombud, in your proposal, you suggest that the ombuds should report to this committee. The law, the proposed law, the bill says that the tax ombud reports to the Minister of Finance. Why do you have a problem with it reporting to the Minister? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My point is to have been a large extent been covered by my colleagues, but just on the ombud as well, just to PwC, where you indicating that the ombud will not be impartial or neutral. But in terms of the Act, it's only the staff that is seconded by SARS, but the ombud himself, is not. It doesn't say in the Act that the ombud himself are coming from SARS. So that person will probably be an independent because it's appointed by the minister and then is accountable to the minister. So I just want clarity on that argument of yours, please. Thank you very much.
Honourable Van Rooyen?
No, Chair, my main question has been covered, the on search and seizure approach. But on the ombuds, I think it will be good for me if I can get to know what is the take of the two presenters on how do they think that we need to approach the issue of staffing or maybe appointing the ombuds and the office if we say we must not consider people from SARS for such an assignment. Thank you.
Prof, and your team, Ms. Tian will also follow.
Okay, thanks, Chair and members. I'll expect Kyle to jump in, and we'll do our best. From the questions that I have, I'll try and, when we deal with privilege or the ombud, I'll try and see if I can answer the majority of them together. First of all, as regards the privilege, the legal professional privilege, if we can start with that first, there are a couple of questions there. And one of them was, do we support the point that Stian Kluh made about the reference to tax practitioners as opposed to just accountants? Now, obviously, we are a firm of accountants, and that's why we made that point. But I think absolutely we do, and you would have seen in our slides, we refer to non-lawyers. I mean, like, lawyers have privilege in some cases, and what we're saying is non-lawyers. And we do essentially mean people who have the appropriate tax qualifications. So not accountants per se, but just repeating the point that Stian was making, we do mean tax practitioners generally. And if we end up with some kind of regulation of that, anyway, that's fine, we support that. But just keep in mind our reference to accountants as well is that several accounting bodies do already have their own internal disciplinary and regulatory processes, which adds as additional safeguard. Do you want to add anything to that point?
No, thank you. You addressed it all, then.
Okay. Then just one of the questions is, why do you need privilege? And I think going back to the common law concept that Kyle mentioned in our presentation, and if I can use some real live examples, again, let's not be in denial about the fact that you have non-compliant taxpayers. Now, there is no doubt in my mind, and certainly I can speak from personal experience within our firm, that the likelihood of there being some kind of confidentiality increases the chances of a non-compliant taxpayer coming to you and saying, this is everything. I'm not holding back. I'm not lying to you. I'm not keeping any information from you. And in every single case that I've seen, and I can, again, only speak for PwC, our response to that client would be, okay, you know what, you're in trouble, but there's only one way out here. We need to go to SARS. If you want us to come with you and hold your hand, that's fine. But we are not going to have access to that kind of information where we can enhance compliance, where the non-compliant taxpayer who does want to come onto the grid, who does want to regulate his affairs, his or her affairs, and they can go to a lawyer and they, for some other reason they can't come to a tax practitioner. So that is really the sole purpose as far as we're concerned, why we say there needs to be some kind of privilege. And remember, that is the same basis for the existing privilege. I mean, in criminal matters, for example, the lawyer needs to know everything in order for the client to understand how much trouble he's in. So that's really the point. Did you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that addresses it. The point is to encourage
non-compliant taxpayers to make full disclosure of it. And it's been said, there's lots of debate and discussion documents around this very point. The point there is that legal privilege, we're not for legal privilege. Non-compliant taxpayers would be far less likely to come forward and disclose everything if SARS, for example, could simply go and access that information from their advisors once they had made disclosure. So that's the point behind it.
If I can perhaps just turn to search and seizure, and I think we do quite emphatically want to say, I hope Carl's going to agree with me on that, that we do support search and seizure without a warrant. I mean, I think, the two questions I think the two opposing positions we need to look at here, and this is an example I think I remember either from Katanka or France from SARS when we had this discussion. I mean, imagine you're a SARS auditor and you're going for an inspection, and very suspiciously someone in the back room is shredding files or stuffing stuff into a bin and burning them and things like that. You don't have the time to go and get a warrant and all of those kind of things. So My question here is, let us not be in denial that those kind of taxpayers exist. But so the level of maturity that we're at is that we've gone beyond this thing of saying we can't have search and seizure without a warrant. We're saying we do need it. SARS does need it, and the majority of clients of compliant taxpayers will say, we don't want those people stealing tax money effectively by not paying their fair share, so we want SARS to have the power to go in there. But by the same token, I want to say, I want to use the different example. I mean, if I have a fallout with Dr. George and I tomorrow apply for a job with SARS, Franz, I hope I can get a job as a senior SARS official if I do apply. I don't know, but if I then facetiously go and decide, okay, I have the authority to burst into your house and search and seize whatever I consider, whatever I want to, is there anything in this bill that protects you? And there's nothing. So all I'm saying is, we can't be in denial about the first scenario, and we support that. Just don't be in denial about the second scenario, that you have humans who have the ability to abuse the power. So,
if I could just add to that point, as I was going to say, we are in support of the power to search and seize without a warrant in appropriate circumstances, and we have no problem with the circumstances that are prescribed in the bill itself. What we do have a problem with is that those powers can be invoked where a senior SARS official is of the view that those circumstances exist. What we're suggesting is that there needs to be a check and balance in that regard, and perhaps what should be in place is, under normal circumstances for a warrant, you'd be approaching the High Court to issue or a magistrate to issue that warrant, but there should be, subsequent to the actual search and seizure having taken place, there should be a review process before the courts in that respect to review whether or not the circumstances actually existed and whether or not, more importantly, a warrant would have been issued had a warrant been sought for.
Okay, I think there are just two more things. The tax ombud I'll leave for last. The second last thing I wanted to deal with was the question about the collection powers. What do you propose? Was the question. And remember, there's one of the provisions in here that says the person whose tax is being collected has the right to approach SARS and say, look, this is my financial situation, and SARS will have the authority to say, okay, you know what, we're going to be a little bit more lenient with you. But I must admit, that's one of those provisions that puts a smile on my face in a kind of sarcastic way, because there's nothing in there that compel SARS to come to you and say, by the way, we're not happy with your payment record, we're going to take all the money out of your bank account. All that happens is you see that after it's already happened. So what's the point of saying, I give you the right to approach SARS, but you're only going to become aware that this provision has been enacted or invoked after the money is already gone? So what our proposal is and what our request is that there needs to be a process, there needs to be a prevention on applying this unless certain procedures have been followed. Like, have you exhausted all the payment mechanisms? What demand has there been? Have you had the discussion with the taxpayer as to what precisely their their cash flow position is. And I use the example again. If I have 100,000 Rand in the bank account, in my bank account today, because some customers paid me yesterday, and I know I've got to use most of that to pay my employees tomorrow, SARS needs to have that conversation with me beforehand to say, look, you've got cash in the bank, and we're going to take it all because you've been paying badly. What process is there for understanding that? So we, instead of SARS having the ability to just apply this, and if I can just use just one more minute on this particular issue. We said it can't be a first resort, it must be a last resort, and I do want to make the point that as we speak today, it is being used as a first resort. There are many client situations that we can point to, but I can't perhaps mention them because of confidentiality, but there is one in the public domain, and a High Court case, where SARS issued an assessment today and gave the taxpayer 40 days to pay. So the due date was 40 days later, but they actually invoked this provision 3 days later. You think you've got 40 days to pay, because, I mean, 3 days later, the money's gone out of your bank account and no one told you about it. So where's the ability for you to do that? So there needs to be that kind of prevention. And then the last one is on the tax number. Did you want to say anything on the third party?
No.
Okay. Now, just on but I think Carl will probably have more to say to you. I just have a point regarding the staffing that I wanted to make. And this is, I mean, look, there's an ongoing debate about the staffing of SARS, of the Ombud. And it's the whole thing about, I mean, when you have a referee, there's a fine line between saying, on the one hand, the best person to be a referee is the one who used to be a player, and I'm down with that. But there's a difference between that and saying the referee is still part of one of the teams. So there's the issue about the facts and reality, and that is really the point about the staffing of the Ombud that we were making. I don't think we're saying that the Ombud cannot be staffed by SARS secondees. The way it's written now is that it can only be staff secondees. I think what we're saying is, you know, the Ombud should advertise for staff, and if they go through the process and they get a whole bunch of suitably qualified people who happen to be ex-SARS employees, then, you know, great. But having that direct umbilical cord, the permanent relationship between the Ombud and SARS is the thing that I think we have an issue with.
We still have another presenter that must respond. And
there were quite a few questions that were directed to us, and I'm not sure that we've addressed all of them yet in the interest of the members.
Just get straight into your...
Certainly. Just to pick up on that point, and so on, I agree with what Osman is saying in terms of secondments. The question was also asked in relation to, SARS expressed the view that the secondees would understand SARS systems better. Well, I don't think that's a critical factor here. I mean, what you've got to remember is that in terms of what the Ombud is doing, he's looking at the administration of your tax law. He's not looking at tax law itself. So what those secondees need is an understanding of this legislation and of administrative law. They don't need to have a detailed understanding of tax law or knowledge of SARS systems as per se. They need to understand the administrative aspects of it. I don't want to dwell on the independence issue, so I think maybe we should move on. But just some of the other points that were asked, the question was asked, are we in a rush for this piece of legislation to come through? And our view on that would be no. I think SARS would have a very different answer, that they want these additional powers. But I don't believe that this legislation should be rushed through if we're not happy that the necessary checks and balances are in place and that there is sufficient balance in this bill between the additional powers granted to SARS and taxpayers' rights. So I would suggest no, this bill should not be rushed through if we are not happy with it. There was one other point that was raised, and that was around the additional powers granted to SARS and whether or not we were part of the consultation process in that regard. Yes, we were part of the consultation process, and these matters that we've highlighted here are nothing new. They have been raised as part of that consultation process and either dismissed or ignored from the point of view of SARS. So this is not new to them.
You're done from your side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll be quick. In terms of the last question, I'm going to start off with Carl's last answer, as that is fresh in your mind. There has been a consultation, but is it consultation for the purpose of being consultation, or is it being taken up seriously? And that's the question. And that is basically why, when I worked on our submission, the majority of the proposals or the concerns that we've raised today are used exactly from 2008, wherever it started. So it's not something new, it has been raised, and it is, like I'll point out, just been not being incorporated or at least debated to the next level so that we can all get onto the same page. And that is why I devoted my discussion to take a step back so that we view this holistically, what is on the table. So that takes me to the next question about the rush. I think we should again learn from our experiences. Another committee heard the New Companies Act, and we all know what happened with the New Companies Act. So I'm just concerned that if we rush into it, we may have the same egg on our face that our country is having currently with the New Companies Act. So what I'm just warning to the committee is that let's learn from our experiences and our mistakes from the past and take a step back and make sure that we achieve what we ultimately want to achieve with the legislation, and that's before you. On the question about a doctor in terms of why we need legal professional privilege, it also came up in my mind earlier when Carl presented on that, and it's obviously on my presentation as well, so it came across as if we are trying to hide something. No, it's not. I think, again, take a step back, and it's about perception. If the public taxpayer perceives the system as unfair, that he can only go to his attorney or to a attorney that he doesn't know, his accountant, he'd rather want to go to his accountant or tax practitioner to come open and say, in anticipation of litigation, I would like to come to you and let's see how we can address this. And without incriminating himself, share things with his tax advisor so that they can address the issue and then go to an attorney. Otherwise, again, it's a perception issue. So I think also we should not confuse, and I think SARS would raise that issue, and I know I think France is of that view, that we're confusing legal professional privilege. It's not day-to-day activities that we are asking legal professional privilege for. It's for legal professional privilege in anticipation of litigation. So an accountant and a tax practitioner and a non-lawyer can represent his accountant or his client at, for example, the tax court and the ADR process. So that's the litigation process already started. So it is to extend legal professional privilege, maybe, I don't like the word limited, otherwise where do you draw the line to limited, to tax practitioners. Then on the tax ombud staffing question, again, there are many arguments for and against it. When we leave the room, SARS will argue whatever they want to argue in support of it or against it in terms of what's on the table. Again, I think we need to take a step back and look at it holistically. And the real concern here is the master-servant relationship. If the staffing is seconded by SARS, will it be a toothless body? Will it be just another SARS service monitoring office with a different name? We have seen that in South Africa again, companies and organizations changing name, but it's still the same organization, still with the same problems, still with the same challenges. Are we really achieving what we're trying to achieve? Again, taking a step back and determining where we want to go with this. The tax ombud reporting to the minister. During our conference last year, we had Nina Olsen, the U.S. taxpayer advocate, which is the equivalent tax ombudsman for the U.S., presenting via live streaming from the U.S. And she pointed out exactly that concern, is that if the ombud
or the advocate report directly to the minister or to revenue, the reports may be sanitized. It's not an allegation. It's not saying that's going to happen. Again, it's about the perception. So, on the question whether the ombudsman report directed to Congress in the U.S., that's happening in the U.S., that's an example, and Carl supported that. Again, we support it as well. I think we just have to, and also what Nina pointed out to us in terms of her experience in the U.S., is that officials don't take criticism lightly. So if it's been reported to Parliament, to the committee, they may see it as to think twice before, for example, they just take the other side of the equation by certain seizure without a warrant and just act in terms of loosely, in terms of executing that power. So the Ombud reporting to the committee would report on matters of that nature. So it will not be sanitized, and that is her experience in the U.S. It's not sanitized. It's first delivered to Parliament, to the chairman of their committee, and then she pick up the phone as she walk out of Congress, inform her deputy to hand over the report also to the commissioner. It's at the same time, it's just that whole perception that the public would get Parliament oversight in terms of the process. And also then obviously there's no collusion between the revenue and the Minister of Finance. So that is the experience. I'm not saying that's going to happen in Africa. It's just the experience. So that is hopefully enough to answer that question. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Let me take this opportunity to thank you for your time and the preparations that you have made. We always have had very interesting and very fruitful and educative presentation from yourselves. And obviously, whatever the committee comes out with as a report, it takes into consideration all these inputs that you make. And we're very, very much grateful that you really take the work of SARS and in the interest of the general public very, very serious. Thank you very much. Honorable members, let's have a 10-minute leg stretch, comfort break. Some prefer it that way. Thank you.